Welcome to a new episode of the China Flexpat Podcast. Today we have Gábor, who is an international leadership coach, and he just wrote a book about dragon suits, which describes the entire expat life cycle from come to China to maybe leave China. And it also features the China Flexpat Podcast in many areas. I have learned a lot from Gábor myself, and he's been on our show in episode 20 on leadership careers. And it's really good to learn from him. With this, welcome, Gábor.
Hello, Francis. Indeed, my name is Gábor Holsch. I'm an intercultural leadership consultant, which means I help high-level managers, executives, mostly of large multinational companies, but sometimes smaller companies, startups, entrepreneurs, to overcome the intercultural challenges, the cultural challenges of leadership work, leading others, leading teams. And most of the time I work on the East-West relationships, which means that I either work Western companies to work in East Asia, or I work with East Asian managers promoted to high-level international leadership positions in Western multinationals. Or increasingly, I think this is the most recent and most interesting segment of my market, working with leaders of newly multinationalized Asian companies, and specifically Chinese companies. That is something quite interesting. Otherwise, when I coach, when I advise, when I train, when I make a conference keynote, it is always mostly the same message, mostly the same topic of intercultural leadership on the West to Asia aspect. And indeed, my recent book, Dragon Suit, is also partially about this topic. So it's about multinational executives in China over the last 20 years.
Gábor, how did you first come to China and how did you get to where you are today?
It is a long and fairly complex story, which is put together from both personal and professional ambitions. So if you look at my studies, I started studying languages and philosophy, which is practically not good for too many things. So I really didn't know what to do with myself. But at that time, I was already quite interested for the philosophical aspect in East Asian philosophy. So when I was a philosophy major, if I had elective courses on Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and so on, if I could, I took those lessons. I also did martial arts. So I did karate and kung fu since I was a teenager. So I already had a basic interest in Asian culture. And then when I finished my studies, I didn't know what to do with myself. I worked as a researcher for a while. I worked as a translator and interpreter for training courses. But then I went back to graduate school and I finished a master's in international relations and another degree in diplomacy. They sent me to the former Yugoslavia, where suddenly the two things, the personal interest in Asia and the professional interest in diplomacy, came together, and I decided to work for development missions in Asia. At which point I quit my job at the security organization in Europe, which sent me to the former Yugoslavia, and I came to China in 2002 with two suitcases in the hope of finding a job in something like the Asia Development Bank or UNHCR or one of these organizations. But 3 years after that, in 2005, I found myself starting up my consulting company, which I still lead.
That's really amazing. I really like this, how you have this odd background and then you make the best out of it and try to sell your know-how, what you still do today. That's really great. So what would you say, Gábor, is the challenge of expats and flexpats in 2023?
I think the main challenge, actually, I could answer both in the same way, because I think the primary challenge in comparison to something like, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago, is that the world deals with international mobility in a different way. You could say I was a flexpat because I arrived in China without employment. I just started looking for something to do. But at that time, China was rapidly integrating. It was opening up, the WTO, where China joined just 1 year before I arrived in China. The motto of China joining the WTO was welcoming the world with open arms. So very much you could feel the sign of the times. Now, for obvious reasons, during the last couple of years, international mobility in general decreased. And I don't just mean people moving to China. I don't even just mean people visiting China on business. I even mean tourism. it basically international tourism dried up. And that's very important because that's how people learn about the country, right? Many of the executives that I interviewed for the Dragon Suit book, if somebody reads the book, you will see that the first thing that comes to the mind of those people who are earmarked for a China job is how can I visit China and just, you know, get the flavor a little bit and see if I have a good chemistry with the place. And this is much more difficult today than it was quite a few years ago. And I think the rest of the expat and flexpat challenges are obviously similar in China today than some other countries previously, or it depends what you compare it to. But this primary first challenge is completely different because very, very few expats and flexpats today arrive in China after visiting China briefly, just to see if it would work out. And that was more the trend before.
Let's take it a bit more strategic. Why is China a key market for global companies?
I think it's mostly for the size and for all the work that Chinese and international counterparts put into this country for the last 25 years. So China is one of the big success stories of this kind of globalized supply chains and people who wanted to go beyond cultural and geographic barriers in order to, I hate the word optimize, but I think in this case, it is actually a good one. People wanted to see which place is good at what. China is obviously good at scale, and there were lots of things that we needed at scale, starting from furniture, from mobile phones for baseball hats, sneakers, but also up to cars, medical equipment, and whatnot. So it turned out that China is very helpful in this kind of context. And then China gradually became the center in manufacturing certain things and also the center for consuming certain things. And this is not going to go away just because there was a global pandemic and just because politically the relationship is much more fraught. What you can see these days is that political relationships are turning quite sour. It is, the barriers are much higher, but business people on both sides of this fence, of this ever higher fence, they are doing what they can to jump over it and throw things over it and communicate with each other. So actually, governments sometimes try to stop something, and then corporations immediately try to get around the barriers. China being a very important part of this global chain is not going to change, in my opinion.
So why are expats usually not well prepared to come to China?
China has never been an easy place to see through. And that is not a coincidence. It is one of the side effects of Chinese culture. Even if you just know individual Chinese people, you know how carefully Chinese people engineer their public image, how they behave with others, especially people that they don't know, the politeness culture of this country, the completely different behavior towards family members and strangers. If you are, if you meet Chinese people in a professional context, then people behave in completely different way with their boss, with their colleague, with somebody that they don't work together with. The higher up you go, the more carefully crafted this public image is, which means you know as much about China as China wants you to know about China. And that is not very easy when you want to figure out how this country actually really works. But then every time there is some kind of a challenge in international cooperation, it adds to the previous challenge. For example, you can imagine, I am an intercultural leadership expert. I wrote this recent book, which is about how to lead teams, how to work with the Chinese idea of hierarchy, how to build up your professional network. But I get emails every week, Gabor, do you know how I can get a credit card as a foreigner in China? You see what I mean?
There's very basic things, I understand. Yeah, it's so frustrating.
These kind of little things add up to the point where people have extremely little idea what they can expect when they go into China, but obviously they are afraid that by the time they are in China, it's going to be too late. If you don't have a credit card that you can use in China, by the time you are in China, it's too late to think about this. Obviously, one of the things that everybody knows about China is the Great Firewall. They know that if you enter the country without the proper preparation, then it's going to be too late because now you cannot prepare. This is why people have this feeling, and I think very often they are justified, that they simply don't know what awaits them if they go to China on a business trip, which is beyond a couple of days, or if they move there as expats or flexpats.
And those who come here, who manage to stay, why do they leave?
Well, first of all, not all of them leave. There are a lot of international, very well settled experts, but also investors, artists, entrepreneurs, whatever you want, who imagine their life in China in the long run. And those are the people that I am very often in touch with these days, because they form an extremely important bridge right now between China and the outside world. Because Chinese people, their exposure to the rest of the world is quite limited in these days. Probably people who are listening to us know that it is harder to get international visas. It's harder to renew your passport. And there is less willingness to travel outside of China, to be honest, because unfortunately, because of media coverage, we hear the bad things about each other on both sides. And the expats and flexpats who arrive in, perhaps this is more true about expats who are sent there by their company rather than flexpats who willingly go to China. The length of time that they spend in China is again shorter. Very often when somebody is sent to China, now they send expats into China for 1 or 2 years rather than, let's say, 3 or 4 or 5, partially for administrative reasons because of visa and so on, and partially because many people have second thoughts about if they want to stay in China. So basically these shorter term assignments are like a trial, whether they are going to work out there in the longer run. Those people who leave, many of them leave because simply their assignment expires. This is, I think, the vast majority of people. Simply, they wanted to stay for 2 or 3 years. They stay for 2 or 3 years. During the COVID, this big wave of some people would call it an exodus. Also, that's another word I'm not very much in favor of. Many of them were basically repatriated by their company because the company didn't want to take the risk of keeping them in the country. It's a very, very hard-nosed project-related risk management issues. Many of them were repatriated with a company because the family didn't feel comfortable inside of China when schools were closed down for an extended period of time. The mobility of the family within the country was limited. They couldn't travel home for like 1 or 2 times a year and so on. Many of them left because of that. And I think there is a minority who simply had been thinking about leaving China for a while. And then that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Now, Gabor, there have been expats and flexpats in the country for 20 years, and they have always been working with Chinese professionals. Now, the key question is, can these Chinese professionals achieve the same output like expats or flexpats? Can they learn this international mindset, the way how to do this, the international way, the more broad connection to headquarters? Is this something you can train?
No, you shouldn't. Actually, for a country with international ambitions, this should simply not happen. A country that is first of all aspires to and also has had very good successes of becoming a huge international factor in economy, in trade, in increasingly in research and development and service and so on, is not supposed to replace international workforce with locals. I mean, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, or Japan shouldn't do it either, or France, or whichever other country. If you replace the word China with the name of any of these countries, then that's where we can see that it makes absolutely no sense at all. Obviously, China needed a different number of foreigners and needed them in a different way than in the, let's say, early phase of its development as an important international actor. There have been international expats in China for the last 25 years. But remember that there were expats in China before that.
Yeah, there's the book Beijing Jeep, right? About expats in China in the 80s.
Even before that. So ask somebody who is over 70 or 80 in China, and then they still remember where most of the foreigners who look like you and me in the streets of Beijing and Shanghai were Russians. Or one of these, some of my family members worked in China. And then the Soviets left, and then came the early investors from European countries, and then also from Asian countries, and then Americans and so on. So there was always a function to those people being there. Obviously, any economy in the world, they would get things done with local workforces as long as it makes sense. And when then it doesn't make sense for certain reasons, then come the international workforce. Now, in an early phase, let's say around the time when I arrived in China, the biggest reason for international workforce to be there is that foreign investment, foreign equipment, foreign know-how, and foreign services entered the country, and local Chinese people didn't know how to manage those. So the typical expat was an early startup expert who took care of starting an international entity in the People's Republic of China, because why would Chinese managers who grew up in state-owned companies know how to create a foreign Chinese joint venture? Nobody knew those things. Companies, international companies imported technology. Why would Chinese people know how to manage that technology, how to install the software, how to provide the services? So that's why if you imagine it visually, in let's say the first 5 to 10 years, what you could see is expats were mainly these kind of icebreakers who brought these early know-hows and concepts and technologies into China.
That's a SWAT team.
Something like that, yes. And then as the volume grew, in China, the volume of business always grows much faster than the population and the workforce. It's always the case because China is very good at scaling up, but it's very difficult to scale up people, to scale up talent and expertise. So what happened is that most multinational companies, they created this weird pyramid whose top 20% consisted of international workforce. There was a foreign CEO, and then the CFO and the CEO, they were also foreign, and there were some lead engineers, and down to mid-management, they were foreigners. And then after that came the local workforce. Now, this local workforce, partly because deliberate localization efforts by the international companies, and partly because Chinese people wanted to work hard and be promoted in these companies, this glass ceiling started to shatter. And then on these levels, these higher levels, you get a mixed foreign Chinese workforce. But please remember, already at that point, international and local employees compete with each other. We have this situation today because there are certain things that Chinese people don't do so easily. So research shows, for example, that Chinese people didn't learn foreign languages as fast as their international employers hoped that they would. Restrictions on Chinese people traveling internationally didn't go away as fast as multinational companies hoped that they would. So today, international workforce, international managers, fill an extremely important function of connecting the local entity, and that can be the local branch of an international company, or it can be a Chinese company, with the rest of the world.
There's a bridge builders.
They are bridge builders. Now, if China does its job well, and if China realizes its international ambitions, then the volume of tasks to get done is still going to grow much faster than the available workforce in China, for demographic reasons, but also for lots of other reasons. So this kind of full localization would make absolutely no sense at all.
And what would be the risk if this would happen? So if companies would have no international employees in their whole operation in China?
Well, the risk is very simple to imagine. So just imagine almost like you create a cartoon about this, you know, like an animated film about localization in China. And then imagine a meeting room and 10 people around the meeting room. And you start off with something like, let's say, 4 international managers and 6 local Chinese managers. Now, take away all the foreign managers and only Chinese managers are left. So what is it that they cannot get done? So none of them have family members abroad. None of them have the kind of network that international people have. If somebody says, listen, in Singapore, in 3 days, there is a trade fair, and one of our very important stakeholders is going to be there, and somebody has to hop over, the Chinese managers, they are much less likely to be able to hop on a train and travel to Singapore for visa reasons, for example. They are much less likely to speak French, Japanese, or both. There are lots of these objective reasons why a nation, a city, a company with international ambitions must be an international environment itself. There is a reason for that.
Gabor, it's a shaky and very difficult topic, but can you say something about compliance and, you know, stuff that is not going the way it should be? And which role do expats and flexpats play to make sure that international companies run compliant in China?
Well, I mean, we have to remember that in the last couple of years, we have gone through a time when, first of all, people were cut off from each other. People just simply didn't travel to the places where they did business. They connected virtually. Willy-nilly, I mean, some of them wanted to travel, some of them really didn't want to travel, but business partners haven't seen each other in years. When I coach executives, when I simply discuss their business with them, they always bring up that if there is no face-to-face interaction, then trust starts weakening. Even people who worked together very closely before, now if they haven't seen each other for a couple of years, you know, humans are organic beings. They change their opinions, they change their way of working. So if somebody that you haven't seen in 3 years, can you trust them the same way that you can trust somebody that you meet every second month or even work together in a daily basis? We also shouldn't forget that this coincided with a time when political and economic tension increased. Just forget about this kind of new clashes between United States and trade wars between China and most of its top trade partners, including West, but also East, including United States and Germany, but, you know, also Japan, Australia, and so on. So you have a situation where even if we didn't have the pandemic, it would be difficult to trust each other, more difficult to trust each other now. But since there was a pandemic, it undermined trust. And this is something when I coach executives, I hear again and again that they don't know what's the chicken and what's the egg. We don't trust each other because anything could happen in one of the business units that I haven't visited in 3 years, or because when, let's say, my international boss is not here and I am a Chinese decision maker, then I allow myself more flexibility with, for example, compliance issues. You know, so in China, for example, there is a very specific, very tangible question. Who has the stamp of the company?
I hope not the wrong person.
Well, this is it. I mean, and this is a huge issue. The other day, I was listening to a podcast about Arm, the British company owned by SoftBank. So who has the stamps? This was one of the big questions. And international managers in China have nightmares about who has the stamp and what they do with it. And this is just a stamp. Who has the passwords to certain banking software? Who can access certain information? What they are going to do with it? Nothing terrible has to happen for people to start suspecting each other.
Gabor, the main issue is what happens if you order something from a supplier and maybe there's a kickback, right? This is what is always...
I hesitate to use the word research because this is usually anecdotal evidence, but it is systematically collected evidence that, first of all, because of this long period of not communicating intensively with each other, first of all, people are more afraid that something like this happens. And then secondly, that it actually happens more often now than 5 years ago. So in this respect, this kind of trustful relationship had a build up, and unfortunately now it has a build down. Actually, there is, you don't have to be an executive coach like myself who listens to these stories under strict confidentiality. You can go online and you can find these stories in media, you know, exactly as you said, who started taking kickbacks, who misused information and, you know, just took a hard drive and went over to the competition.
Or hired his brother and sister and uncle and whatever. Yeah.
Precisely. And what you said just now is, for example, a very good example, because whether you are supposed to hire a brother or sister or cousin is a culturally dependent factor. So in some cultures, hiring one of your family relatives is a violation of certain corporate principles. But let's say if they are not watching me too closely, then I will allow myself a little bit of flexibility with this. But there are other cultures, and many of them are in Asia, where actually, according to local standards, local values, it's not a bad thing to hire your family member because those are the people that you can trust. The only reason you didn't do it so far, because there was a foreign boss behind you who didn't allow you to do it.
Yeah, he didn't allow you.
So now that foreign boss is not there to basically second guess your decisions. And let's not forget that in recent couple of years, one of the things that happened in China is that a lot of international companies, from startup to multi-billion multinationals, they had to move most of their operations over to locally registered entities. So localization is not just localization of management, it's also localization of legally incorporated entities. And then the international boss has less discretion, less influence on who you hire and what your reasons are.
Gabor, now we understand that we need foreigners, flexpats in China. Maybe international companies are not able to send their expats to China for the reasons that you explained before. So if flexpats apply for top management positions in MSEs in China, and they don't have the network in headquarters, and they also don't have the special know-how about this company, this industry, this technology, this whole ecosystem. So how can they compete? How can they show their value and also justify their probably a little bit higher salary package?
First of all, I mean, hopefully there is a reason for this hypothetical foreigner to choose that company to be employed in. And then if there is a specific reason, it is either expertise or some kind of relationship. This is usually the way human life works. But let's put it aside and let's say none of these are there. I like going visual. Close your eyes, use your mental screen to walk into this company, talk to those colleagues, talk to your future boss. And how can you make their life much easier with the kind of skills that you bring into it? I will give you a couple of examples. Language is a huge issue. in the 2000s, China created an entire generation of foreign educated Chinese experts who spoke foreign languages. But research shows that the willingness to study abroad in China is waning away. It's decreasing. So that means that there is going to be a huge need for people who speak multiple languages, obviously one of them Chinese. I know people who actually at the beginning had very, very little to offer except fluent Chinese, fluent English, and the chosen other language that they could speak well, which could be French, Japanese, German, Korean, whatever it is, to be this kind of connector, because skills you can learn, the product you can learn, human relationships and language skills, very difficult to build up. And this is definitely one of them. It could be something else. It could be your heritage. You may come from a country that this employer has a strong interest in. It could happen that you have some kind of a drive. You know, you're an excellent networker, or you are very good at learning new software or something like this. If you failed all the three tests, you basically have no expertise in their field. You have no connection to the headquarters and you cannot find anything to this third question that I asked you. Then I would start thinking whether I really should put my energy into this job hunt.
Gabo, I think you perfectly explained the FlexPet, because this is what I always say. First of all, yes, Chinese skills and your native language and English is a very good combination. If you speak all three, it's really, really good. But it's still, I would say, it's not enough. You need an additional skill, maybe a background industry skill, something that you can leverage. And then you have the chance to take these roles. But also, I think if you enter a new company, you have to be very quick to show your value and you don't have as much time as an expat does. So you have to prove your value that you fit into this new organization, this new culture in China and also in headquarters quite quickly, that you kind of become part of the team, the international team. So I want to ask you, Gabo, how do European companies, especially European companies, how do they accept FlexPets in China in 2023 for top management positions?
How do you say? There is an interesting thing here. I get emails very often from Chinese speaking and sometimes former China expat managers who are trying to get back to China and they are trying to find a job there. And I get desperate calls from international companies in China that they are looking for international or at least English speaking foreign educated managers. But somehow these two groups just don't find each other.
So they don't fit.
Yeah, they either don't fit or they don't find each other. So I would say that international companies would absolutely welcome FlexPets as long as they don't have to solve too many problems before those people can take their first day at work.
So they have to be employable, right? They have to be kind of be able to be on the job in 2 months. Nobody wants to pay for a relocation, right?
For example, the visa policies don't make it easy. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be very easy in China, just like in any other Asian country, to enter the country, then get some kind of teaching job or be a salesperson for a real estate company or something like this. You got some kind of visa that was in the middle and then you're to do your job hunt. Or to come to China as a student and then you start looking around when you graduated for an internship and then for employment. It came very, very close to being impossible now in China to do this. So basically one or two very important sources of international workforce has dried up. And then the other thing is obviously companies phased out these expat packages when you have the great international health insurance and the international education for the kids and two tickets home every year. So this has been phased out and everybody knows that. But being a FlexPet is not as easy as many people think without this package. So now people have to think, let's say, if I want to work for one of these big multinational companies, and then I am with my family here, and let's say my spouse is not employed, how are we going to live our lives? And if you read Dragon Suit, then, I mean, you already remember these stories, not only new expats, but also people who switched from an expat contract to a local contract.
Yeah, that's expat to FlexPet, yeah.
Exactly, but they never anticipated certain challenges. Right? They never anticipated like a very hard bargain.
It's a different job. It's really a different kind of job. It is.
The whole lifestyle. You just don't think, okay, wait a minute. I have to haggle with my employer for how much of my kids' education is going to be paid, or am I supposed to send my kids to a Chinese school? Am I supposed to go to local hospitals now? How does it even work? You know, China's expat infrastructure or FlexPet infrastructure is at a very, very early stage of development, right? You meet very, very few foreigners. As you said, there have been a lot of foreigners in China for the last 20, 30 years, but you don't meet a lot of foreigners who retired in China. This has reasons because the whole infrastructure of staying over in China after you're not employed anymore is simply not there.
So Gabor, I do hope that the flexpats who actually listen to this podcast and learn from you, read your book, that they actually fit this job profile, which is employable, which is able to take these jobs and able to kind of fit into the package which the companies are willing to pay and still provide this additional value. And I do hope that they do this, that they read your book and that they reach out to you and learn from you. But I want to learn one more time from you, Gabor. What is the value that you bring into this whole change now in these 5 years? What would you say is your value proposition to both people, expats, flexpats, but also companies to master this transition?
Well, I think the main advantage of being a coach and advisor is that as opposed to most of the people that you talk to, you work with, let's say, 5 different companies a week. So you can pick up the worst practices, you can pick up the best practices, and then basically you turn them into coaching solutions or you include them in your advisory. The learning curve is extremely sharp so that if something new happens, for example, okay, China now closed down, China now opened up again, in a week or two, you already hear 20 different kind of solutions, how people solve their problems. Like, for example, okay, now China opened again. Are we sending our expats back into the country immediately? Or are we going to keep in touch with our China branch virtually a little bit more? And also after 25 years of being in the consulting industry, I can back these things up with theory and with some models that help me predict if this goes in the right direction or not. So if somebody is interested in that, for example, recently Eurobiz magazine published one of my articles about in China for China, which is a strategic buzzword.
Hello. Local for local.
Yes, exactly. Local for local. And in that article, I try to explain to decision makers, this is a temporary situation. Don't get too comfortable with it. Don't build your 3 to 5 year strategy on China, China for China, because this phenomenon came out of a huge trauma to the global supply chain in whose center we can find China itself. So I think this is the primary example. Of course, coaches, advisors, they work under strict confidentiality. If I learn something from your competitor, I'm not going to tell you where I learned it, but it's still going to be a relevant message and we can turn it into application for your daily business.
Now China is going everywhere. You've heard of the news about the IAA, the auto show in Munich, and Germans were like really scared. The Chinese are coming. How will young professionals learn to deal with an increasingly China-focused economy?
Now it almost sounds like a coaching session because there is a way to approach it. Basically, not just between China and the rest of the world, but between any two cultures that has a, let's say, a long enough distance from each other, culturally speaking. And as coaches, we use certain culture mapping methodologies. If you read Dragon Suit, I actually briefly introduce it. At the beginning, we always have to push through our fears of the other culture. And although many people think it's this fear of the alien is genetically coded, actually it's not. We learn it when we are children. But that fear is definitely there. You have to do this little by little, like any other fear. You know, when a psychologist tries to heal somebody from their phobias, like claustrophobia or fear of snakes. You do it step by step. And when I coach people through this challenge, what I usually do is I show them methodologies to break this down to person-to-person relationships, not to start working with groups, but finding some kind of ally, person who is familiar with both cultures to some extent, who can be your kind of sidekick, like Dr. Watson for Sherlock Holmes. And very often, you already have people around you that can help you. So let me give you an example. I am working with a technology company here in Europe in a number of countries where the problem is that the research and development managers here in Europe, they theoretically work with their counterparts in China, but they only have, let's say, MS Teams calls and emails with each other. So they know very little about each other. And then obviously both sides think that the other side is weird. Basically, what I do in this case is I don't try to give skills people to work with a Chinese team, but I encourage them to get in touch with the person on the other side that they already know the most about. And very often it's a kind of accidental thing, like, for example, at one of the MS team calls, they mentioned that both of them like football or both of them has twins, or it doesn't have to do anything about work, but maybe their professional background is similar or they are passionately interested in the same aspect of the product. And then to start working in a very trustful relationship with that person, to ask them, listen, let's say, dear German colleague, if I send you an email and you don't reply within the same business day, what does it mean in Germany? Is it disrespect? Is it that you're dodging us, or is it perfectly normal? And the same thing from, let's say, a Hungarian or a Polish or a Spanish manager, when they say, could you please tell me, my Chinese friend, what does it mean when you send me an email? Of course, I don't reply, because we don't reply emails within an hour here. And then you send me a WeChat message, and then you try to call me on the phone, and then try to initiate an MS Teams call. So is it that you're angry at me, or is it that something is very urgent, or this is the way you communicate with each other? In a team, it's very difficult to discuss these issues, but one-on-one it's much easier, and then you can build up from there. The same thing about, let's say, an auto show like this. You're not going to understand China, or you're not going to understand the automotive strategy of China, but you can sit down and have a cup of tea, probably not coffee, have a cup of tea with one Chinese person who is familiar with one of these Chinese companies.
Gaba, I'm so thrilled of what you share with us. And I think it's really good that you came into the podcast at the very beginning, then also now when it's much more mature and when there is really flexpats in the country who master to survive the pandemic and are still here in leadership positions, are trying to get there and trying to learn from you. And I want to know from you, Gabor, what are you personally thankful for looking back on your wonderful international career?
Well, first of all, it's great to be back on the podcast, because every one of these podcasts is like a conversation, and I like conversations. That's what I do for a living. You know that I quoted the Flexpat podcast a couple of times in the book, because people said things which kind of, even after thousands of hours of conversations, they just kind of stuck with me. So I'm obviously grateful to everybody who sat down and had a conversation with me, including you, including people who were guests on your podcast, because they very honestly shared their story. And that is absolutely invaluable for me. But all of the executives, CEOs, VPs, people from all kinds of walks of life. I worked with diplomats. I worked with startup entrepreneurs that I coached, and they honestly shared their experience and their challenges as well. For the book, I interviewed dozens of people. They don't even know how much they helped me with just sitting down and talking to me. So sometimes I get this at the beginning of an interview, whether it's for consulting or the book. I don't know. There is not much to say, you know, and then they start telling you absolutely amazing stories. I'm very, very grateful for this.
So you're like a priest, right? People tell you all they know, right?
That's a complex question. But I learn from these people, and I'm glad that they can learn from me as well. And you know what I'm genuinely grateful for, and this is something that I also preach, to choose a profession according to your personal temperament. Don't go into an industry or a profession for money, because you're not going to be competitive there. You are competitive if you really love doing it and you have the talent. You know me a little bit. I have a very short attention span. I'm really not good at technology. So I'm just grateful that I can make my money this way. And I intend to continue and grow as a coach, as an advisor, and a writer.
It's fantastic. It's really fantastic. So what's next for you? You're still young. So what's next?
You have to imagine, I came back to Europe after 25 years away. So it's a very interesting intercultural experience, and with a lot of learning. I am Hungarian. I do some of my work in Hungary now and some in Western Europe. I'm more familiar with the professional culture of Western Europe than I am with the professional culture of Hungary. And then it comes through when I coach somebody, obviously, but even if you make a keynote speech, you just make people listen and laugh and learn in a completely different way in different cultures. So I'm learning quite intensively about it. I would like to make coaching, speeches, and writing a more important part of my portfolio. I had to go back and learn. I'm working on new certifications. There were amazing publications during the past 5 years when I didn't really have time to catch up with them in intercultural studies and consulting. And not to mention, the whole genre of training and coaching is changing very rapidly. So I'm trying to do all of these things at the same time. And of course, I'm fortunate that my work speaks loud enough for itself, so that I have a good network that refers clients to me. So great thanks to everybody who has ever done that.
Well, I hope we can help with this episode. What I really want to know, Gabor, is if somebody listens to this episode, who should they refer this episode to listen to this? And to what is your message? What do you want to share with this person listening to this episode?
Please share it with anybody who gets stuck with any of the issues that we mentioned. If anything that we said could be that little nudge that takes them over. So if there could be somebody who is, let's say, looking for a job in a company, either in Europe or in China, and but they are an engineer, but the kind of engineering that they did is not directly related to the job that they are looking for now, or they studied computers, but they want to be a marketing person now. And they never considered that they might have skills and experiences that could be relevant. So maybe they slap their forehead and they say, language. I see. All right. You know, my mother was Japanese and I speak the language on a conversational level. Maybe that could be useful in China. Or I'm fluent in French and very few people are. Maybe if you think somebody's in that situation, actually sending them a podcast link is easier than sending them direct feedback because, you know, people are quite cautious when...
Listen to Gabor.
Listen to us, exactly, because I'm somebody you don't know and therefore you don't have to listen to me if you don't want to. And also, I would like to recommend this podcast to everybody who only had second or third hand experience or information about China. Because unfortunately, if you open the television or you listen to YouTube videos, I would say 6 out of 10 at least are terribly skewed, terribly, terribly skewed. And I don't care if the podcaster is in China or outside of China. These last couple of years confused all of us. You know, we don't trust anybody. We have been put out to danger. Sometimes we lost family members or we went through very difficult times. We keep looking for triggers to be afraid, to blame and so on. And it's not good for working together. So if you, let's say, want to do business with China or know that China is coming to your business and you only, I don't know China from the local media in your country or somebody who was once there 7 years ago, I think it's good to listen to podcasts like this to know what's going on in China right now.
Thank you very much, Gabor. And I want to say, I don't know your hourly rate. I don't know your coaching session price, but I would say buying your book is a much better deal. So I can very much recommend to everybody to take advantage of this. It's really, if you have a Kindle, the price is really not high. And it's really a good investment to do this. It's also a good thing which you can recommend to your boss or to your business partner, anyone who wants to read one book about China. And it's really a very good recommendation. And it's a kind of a new stuff after so many books being written about China. This is like one summary. And I enjoyed this so much. So I really hope that Flexpads out there and their friends and their business partners can take advantage of all of this know-how and do the best out of it and then try to build up their own profile and their own approach to and with China.
Thank you very much for that. And I would encourage everybody who has read the book to reach out to me, because if you have my full name, it's very easy to find me online. And the other day I got this picture of somebody reading Dragon Suit at the beach.
I saw that picture. I saw that picture. It's fantastic. It's one of the flex pets. I know. Fantastic.
Yeah, these just absolutely make my day. I mean, when I get a review, I'm jubilant, but I get these pictures and I got one from Egypt. I got one from Italy. I got one, a couple from China. Absolutely fantastic. So yes, just feel free to reach out. If you have a question about your career, about your leadership work, I would be very happy to reply, because after all, that's what I do.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much, Gabor, for being a guest for the second time on the China Flexpad podcast. And to all of you out there, if you want to support us, please do as we just said. Please take this episode and share it with anyone who might be interested in this. Just, it takes a few minutes. Just think about who might profit from this. Take a screenshot, take a link, and just send it over and say, take an hour, listen to this. Gabor, thank you so much. 谢谢, 再见.
Thank you for having me and keep up the great work. 谢谢大家.